It is now high season for cultural awards. It's a stretch that lasts from about November with the National Book Awards and goes through January with the Golden Globes, and then the Oscars, which are awarded in a few weeks at near the end of March, and then the Pulitzers. We wanted to look at why the prize machinery has grown so huge in the last few years in the arts and entertainment, and how these things affect the artists and their careers and their work. My special guest today is Stephen Schiff, who writes for The New Yorker, but really makes his living writing movies. He is thus a member of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, an Oscar voter. And as a boy in the early 1980s, he was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in criticism and served three terms as chairman of the National Society of Film Critics. So he knows prizes. Stephen Schiff, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
As an introduction to this discussion, let's listen to a clip from your 1997 adaptation of Lolita.
Oh, great.
She was low, plain low in the morning, standing 4'10" in one sock. She was Lola in slacks. She was Dolly at school. She was Dolores on the dotted line. But in my arms, she was always Lolita. Light of my life, fire of my loins, my sin, my soul. Lolita.
That was the opening scene of the 1997 version of Lolita, starring Jeremy Irons and adapted by my special guest today, screenwriter Stephen Schiff. Stephen, Nabokov never won the Nobel Prize for literature, did he?
No, he never won the Nobel Prize. He should have, and he never did.
And he seems like if there was a mid-20th century, late 20th century guy who should have had it, it was
yeah,
him.
And his influence has been enormous. And, you know, I think he may be the great American writer of the post-war period.
It's funny to hear you say he's the great American writer because we don't quite think of him as an American.
Yeah, but, though. You know, that's the thing. I think Lolita, for instance, is the great American novel of the post-war period. Yes, he's an émigré, but he wrote spectacularly in American English of a very mannered and peculiar sort. And, you know, he lived in America and he taught in America and he made himself an American.
You call it the great American novel of its time. Was that not a daunting thing to try to adapt into a film?
I was probably too dumb to be daunted. At the time, I had spent my life avoiding even thinking about being a screenwriter and didn't have any desire to. What I really wanted to be in life was a writer at The New Yorker, which I was, and I was very happy. And when Lolita, when it was sort of, when I got the hint that I might be welcome to try writing it, I got all excited because it was, to me, the novel of novels. And I just was on fire. I just lit into it and said, this is the best fun a boy ever had. I just went.
So your transition from being a critic and a journalist to being a screenwriter, you slid onto a track and never looked back.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I was very, very lucky. I was many people had been taking a crack at Lolita for Adrian Lyne. James Dearden tried it. He had written Fatal Attraction for Adrian Lyne, then Harold Pinter. They called me to come to L.A. and they said, you know, get the cheapest transportation you've ever gotten. Get the worst hotel room. You might not be paid back, but come and, you know, we'll talk about Lolita. And I did. Then we met again in New York. And while we were meeting in the fancy St. Regis Hotel, Adrian Lyne, the director, kept getting up and going into another room. And what he was doing was hiring David Mamet to write the screenplay of Lolita, which I actually perfectly understand because I had never written a screenplay before. And I wouldn't have trusted me to do so, but I kind of knew that the three words that don't go together in the English language, David Mamet's Lolita, meant that I should just keep at it, and I did. And when I turned it in, they were happy, and a film was being made. And what I didn't realize would happen is that the next weekend, everybody in Hollywood would have read my screenplay.
So that wasn't you didn't have to live down. Oh, that bad review you gave in 1983 entered the Hollywood mainstream?
I was very worried about it. And, you know, what I found out, A, I found out that when I crossed over, I found out that everything I always thought about movies, and I knew as much as any journalist about how they're made and what the process was.
Just to say not very much.
Everything I found out was wrong, completely wrong. The moment I crossed the line, I found that out.
What's an example of something that you absolutely were certain was true and was as untrue as could be?
You know, I like every member of the press, had internalized, really, the auteur theory. And it certainly is a very much easier way to talk about movies than the unwieldy way that one would have to talk about movies to be true about them.
It's simpler to say it is the director's vision and he or she realizes this vision.
Exactly. It's simpler to blame the guy or praise the guy. And it's simpler not to talk about any collaborative process. And we know this in any field. We know that, you know, it's much simpler to name an author than to think about his editor, for instance. We live in a time when, strangely, interpretive artists are more honored than creative artists. Thus, the conductor is more famous than the composer. Thus, the singer more famous than the songwriter. And thus, one might go ahead to say, the director more famous than the screenwriter. I would say the only real auteur is accident. I mean, when you see how a movie is actually made, your jaw drops day after day.
Because it's just a lot of people spending a lot of money in a very short period of time, and it's a miracle that it comes out as good as it does, as often as it does.
And the process itself is by its very nature, very choppy, and it's not like the sustained thing. I mean, we sit in a room and write, you and I, and it's true that that's a little bit choppy. Days are divided and everything, and yet there's a kind of sustained flow. You know, what if you had to sort of turn it all upside down and write the 15th chapter before the second and then move over here and then, you know, it turned out that the location you had in your mind wasn't the real location and then the actor makes a mistake and then can't be there because of another obligation and you're not paying him enough and, you know, it doesn't look like
it's as though the ink and the words and the figures on my screen would disobey me and disappear and go away.
Which they might do to a certain degree, but not to the degree they do in the movies.
I'm Kurt Anderson with the screenwriter and former critic Stephen Schiff, and we're going to talk about what happens after the movie comes out as we look at the world of cultural awards and prizes. Coming up, how an opera competition determines who gets to be a diva. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International.